Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Elite Link Show. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. You know what week this is? Carathon week. My favorite week of the year at WSB. On Thursday and Friday, we are going to be raising money for the Aflac Cancer Center, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And I want you to join me. And you can start right now. Go to WSBRadio.com. You can be the first to donate and be a part of what we're doing this week. Walter Reeves and I will be reprising our annual Inside and Out of the House show, and I have some new gardening malfunction stories for you, and I'm sure Walter has a few for on his end as well. Our number today, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We have a new newsletter that I want you to take a look at. Go to thinklink.com, sign up for the free weekly newsletter on any page of the website. Any page. And it will be delivered to your inbox on Monday morning. You have to do it today, though, to get into the Monday rotation. Monday and Thursday. But the newsletter's got a whole new look and feel. It's got my very favorite color on it, which if you get it, then you can tweet me back and I'll say, yeah, you're right. And we've just got all kinds of new information and new things going on. We also have a thinklink.com store now, back again, after a short hiatus, let's just put it there, where I'm selling my brand new webinar and ebook series called The Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. This is my, and I do think we are going to have an event, by the way. We're just starting to pull it together for maybe end of this year, early next year. But until then, I want you to take advantage of all this great information because, wow, the numbers are looking amazingly strong in Atlanta and in Georgia. The Georgia Realtors just released its monthly housing indicator report, and I thought it was really interesting. And there's so much improvement over throughout the entire state that I thought it really bared going over. So let's start here today, because compared to the first half of 2012, the numbers from the Georgia Realtors Association indicates a very steady recovery for the housing market so far in 2013. So compared to the first half of 2012, in the first half of 2013, the median sales price of homes is up 35%. 35%. And that has happened because most of the low-hanging fruit is gone. The stuff that was available for $5,000 and $10,000, I know we're talking about real houses for sale, has been sold. So median sales price, which is the same number of houses selling before below that price and above, is up 35%. The average sales price is up 24%. The percent of original price received is up 4%. Pending sales are up 5%. The number of days that a home is staying on the market until it's sold is down 16%. That's a good number to go down. And new listings are down 4%, so the inventory is still really tight. Now, here's a number that doesn't make me as happy. The affordability index is down 25% from the first half of last year. So what does that mean, you know, the affordability index? Well, it means that home prices are rising and interest rates are rising. What we had last year and the year before 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 were a combination of these extraordinarily low interest rates and falling home prices. But when home prices start to go up and interest rates are going up, that means affordability is going to be down. It's still down from record. I mean, you know, yeah, it's not as good as the record levels of like in forever, but it's still really good. And that's why if you want to get involved in real estate, if you want to buy something to live in or to rent out, you've got to act now. You've got to know what you're doing because there's a tremendous amount of competition for these homes. We talked, you know, about how hedge funds and private equity groups are moving in and they're buying up homes at $1,000 per, right? And it's like, they're buying, I don't know, lollipops, right? I'm just going to buy a bag of 1,000 lollipops, and I'm going to get a better price than you, and I'm going to pay in cash. And you, meanwhile, are waiting at the checkout register trying to buy 3 lollipops to write a check for them, right? One transaction is going to happen lickety-split, and it's going to be the one that everybody's going to want, and one transaction is going to take a whole lot longer. And you know which that is. So Georgia is clearly rebuilding itself, unlike the city of Detroit, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. There's also some other news to talk about today. There is a movement for margin calls again. Not margin calls, but margin, borrowing on margin. So we saw this, last time I saw this was, I don't know, back in the, I guess like 2003 and 2004, bubble, it's bubble stuff, right? So people have a lot of stocks, and for a long time when stocks fell back, they couldn't borrow on margin because there was no margin. Margin is the difference between what you have and basically what you can borrow against, right? So when you borrow on margin, if you have stock portfolio worth $1 million or $100,000 or $10, right, doesn't really matter what number, and you want to borrow against that, you put, you basically pledge that as collateral, right? It's kind of like taking out a loan. Does this sound familiar? It's like a home loan. Well, that's what this is. And you, one of the most, the best known programs was the Merrill Lynch 100 program, which allowed you to borrow 100% of the stocks that you had with them, or equities that you had with them. You could borrow 100% of it and buy property. Maybe not 100%, 100%, sorry, 100% mortgage, not 100% of the collateral. But anyway, we're starting to see that again. There are lenders out there, investment companies that are allowing you to borrow on a margin. And the number that was reported this week for the amount that people are borrowing on margin is the biggest number in a really long time. A lot of people are borrowing on margin because it's fast. They're borrowing very quickly. And I think they're probably escaping some of the headaches that are going along with traditional lending at the moment. So just another little piece of the recovery puzzle, really. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Let's go to the phones. Hirsch joins us on the line from Atlanta. Hi, Hirsch.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm good. What's going on with you?
Not too much. I just had a couple questions around investing in Atlanta.
Yep.
I've been searching for a home for about the past 2 months, and I've narrowed down my search to condos kind of in the Midtown area. And mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if it makes sense. I have enough to put 20% down, but about 10% of that 20% is in a non-retirement account, a brokerage account, and it's been earning pretty good with mutual funds and ETFs. And my question is does it make sense for me to do a conventional loan and put 5% down and not to touch that non-retirement brokerage account, or to go ahead and liquidate that and use that for a down payment?
So the problem, you're a perfect candidate for these margin loans, right? Because if you sell what you've earned, you're going to owe taxes. And if you haven't owned it for at least a year, you're paying tax on your earnings in the brokerage account at your current margin tax rate. So whatever you're normally paying, if you're in the 28% bracket or the 36% bracket, as opposed to long-term capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
That's annoying, right? Because with federal and state, you could end up paying 30, 40% of your earnings, depending on how much else you earn, and instead of just having that money go straight into the pot for this. So that's one problem with selling it. So you have to decide if you're ready to pay the taxes on that, and you like that it's earning. So now on the other side, okay, so what does it look like if you don't sell? And you've got 5% down, which means you're going to pay a pretty hefty PMI, private mortgage insurance, because
right.
you have to pay that anything over. And that's gotten very, very expensive.
Right.
And 5% is, you know, you pay a higher rate than if it's 15% down. Anything less than 20%, you're putting it down. So now the question is, do you, you know, how does that compare to pay that over time versus paying the tax on the brokerage account?
Right.
And you have to do those numbers because I'm not there for you. I don't actually have your numbers and I can't do the math, but that's the math equation that you want to do. How much more are you going to pay versus on the other side? Now, having super low interest rates is really helpful, but if you want to get rid of private mortgage insurance, you're going to have to pony up the cash at some point in time. So then the question is, do you refinance and it's higher interest rates, and then what does that do to your equation?
Yeah, and when I did the calculations, I think I basically ended up realizing that paying the taxes on that brokerage account was more costly than paying a couple years of PMI, because I can put bonuses and other supplemental income towards the principal to get that debt to equity ratio like to 80% or whatever. But I guess the key thing is that, does it make sense if I'm going to be paying PMI, should I put only 5% or should I put 10%? Because I wanted to keep some cash in reserves just for an emergency, but you know, I don't want to necessarily put all my cash towards a down payment. So that's why I was kind of going back and forth between 5%, 10%, or even 20%.
Yeah, I definitely don't think you should use up all of your cash unless you've got a bonus coming up soon. And if you've got a bonus coming up soon, then you'll actually get more cash right away, and that can replenish your reserves. But if you've done this calculation and you know it's better for you to leave the money in the brokerage account than put it towards here, that's probably what I would do. Or alternatively, you could take a little bit of it, so your tax hit is very small. Proportionately, it's the same, but it's small. And you could put that down to get to your 10% and still leave some money in cash. Or just, you know, you have the brokerage account money, and if you need to liquidate, you will, because that's what it's there for. 18 minutes past the hour, I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Five minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time. Of course, starting with yours. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, already tweeting about what I want to talk about a little later on today, which is jobs and unemployment. And I'll give you a little preview about this now. There was an economist quoted in... what was he quoted in? He was quoted in, I don't know, maybe it was the Wall Street Journal earlier this week, or maybe it was Reuters. Oh, no, it was Huffington Post. That's right. Talking about how the unemployment rate is wrong, the one that the government keeps touting about, you know, we have 7.5% unemployment, and, excuse me, the real number, or I guess the official unemployment rate, is 7.6%, and it might be low by 3 percentage points. The guy who talked about this, and we're going to talk a little bit more about how this is calculated, is one of the people who used to run the government's numbers on employment. And what he says, and this is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, is that when you actually take into account all kinds of people who are actually sitting on the sidelines because they cannot get a job, that instead of it being 7.6%, it should really be about 10.6% true. And this is not the U6. This is just the official unemployment rate. The other thing that is disturbing, I think, and we can talk more about this as well, is that the employment population ratio, the percentage of working age population that is actually working, so working meaning up to 65 or 67 years old, is only at 58.7%. It is well below the peak of 63% before the recession. It is the lowest rate since the early 1980s. That's not good either. And so as we start to see recovery, it's almost as if we're peeling back an onion and there are other problems in the economy that are just not being solved. even though the Wall Street Journal yesterday had a big story about how younger people than ever are buying million-dollar-plus houses. I don't know that we should be judging the economic recovery on that, actually. All right, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Lines are open. We're going to take a short break and come back, do your questions, and talk about jobs in the economy. 404-872-0750, News Talk WSB. Back, everybody, to the Elise Glenk Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. Our phone number is 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time. Follow me on Twitter, at Glenk. We have a Pinterest account. You can go to Facebook, to our fan page, or you can just go to thinklink.com. thinkglink.com and sign up for the free weekly newsletter. It has a new look and feel. Talks about our brand new store and my brand new webinar series, The Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. Take advantage of the cool stuff at the thinklink.com store. It is there for you. There's a 25% discount code in effect for everything at the store. Use the code WSB. If you use the code WSB and you go to the store, whatever it is you buy will get this discount. So whether you're buying one ebook or all of them, they're right there. And we're going to be adding a whole bunch of stuff to the store over the next few weeks. We're redesigning and rebranding and rewriting and I don't know what we're doing. We're re-everything, all of our different products that we have, and we want you to have the advantage of those as well. So go to the thinklink.com store or sign up for the free weekly newsletter, because there's all kinds of details in there as well. And you're going to find out first on the newsletter. That's just how we roll. 404-872-0750 is the number. Lines are open. George joins us on the line now. Hey, George.
Hey, how you doing today, ma'am?
I'm fine, thank you. What's going on with you?
Excellent. I really enjoy your show. I'm actually a chief financial officer for Steel Valor, and as well as an economist and day trader. And I just wanted to kind of clarify what you were talking about on margins earlier, and what margin borrowing is, what the requirements are, what a margin call is. Margin borrowing is not something in which, when you're dealing with securities accounts, that you can liquidate funds. There's generally requirements or percentage requirements based on specific holdings or securities that you have to uphold. Basically, it's the creation of leverage. It's just like what they do for money creation in a fractional banking system.
It's just like a mortgage, which is what I said.
Yeah.
You're borrowing against collateral, which in this case is stocks or bonds or mutual funds or whatever it is that you have in this account, and then they're allowing you to borrow against it. Correct?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And the reason for, in my opinion, the reason for the increased margin borrowing that you're seeing is basically a direct relationship with the interest rate. It has an inverse, the amount of demand of money has an inverse relationship with interest. As interest rate is down, people are going to, you know, they're going to extend more leverage. The reason for extending this leverage, obviously, is that people feel like they can make more money on the market than the cost of borrowing that money. So for that reason, you're seeing an increase, and a lot of the increase in the Dow is because of all the quantitative easing that we're seeing from the Fed. So I think investors out there, I think the outlook is good. Investors see that they believe that they can make more than 6% return, which is generally what you're going to pay on margin borrowing, and in the relationship with that interest rate to what they feel like they can make in the markets, it's obviously reached an equilibrium at this point. That's why there's an increase in margin borrowing. Leverage is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Warren Buffett quoted as saying, you know, if you're smart, you don't need it, and if you're dumb, you shouldn't use it. But I believe that leverage is a very useful tool, and I don't want it to be demonized in any way, but it needs to be used responsibly. And I believe that's the reason for the increased margin borrowing right now, is that people are trying to, enhance their gains.
Yeah, I think that, George, I think that people are trying to enhance their gains too. But you and I both know what happens when the average person tries to be a day trader or market timer, right?
Yes,
and I would venture to guess that if you were that successful as a day trader, you wouldn't also be a chief financial officer and an economist. The truth is, very few people make money as day traders. And if you look at market timers, even the Wall Street Journal said that the number one market timer guy was a guy named Bob Brinker back in 2002, and he totally blew it in 2006, 7, and 8, and 9, and 10. So
well, nobody
gets it right all the time.
And the reasoning for me, you know, operating in many different areas is simply a product of my age, not a product of my success. It's just a means of which I can channel funds in different ways.
You may be phenomenally successful. All I'm saying is that market timing is not a game that I think most people should be playing. And when you are borrowing on margin, you are really betting that the money that you're going to be making is going to be more than, to your point, the money you're paying out. But you're putting a tremendous amount of risk, a tremendous amount of assets at risk. And people sometimes don't even understand what it is they're doing when they do that. And
those things are allocated on a daily basis. So if you think that something's going to move heavy in the very short run, you know, i.e. like a week, 10 days, 15 days, maybe even 30 days, or if you're trading options, it's a tool that you can use and pay a very small amount of interest on a short-term gain.
You can, but it's really not what I think most people should be doing. But, you know, thank you for joining us and for giving us that explanation. I'm sure there's somebody out there who's now going to go look and investigate this. And honestly, I would rather you lock in a 30-year fixed-rate loan. We should point out that most margin loans are not fixed-rate, that they do fluctuate. And so in a rising interest rate, you may end up paying a lot more. It's a little bit more like an ARM than a fixed-rate mortgage. But thanks so much for your call. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the story about the unemployment rate, because I think this is really important to think about when you are out there thinking that the economy is showing dramatic amounts of improvement. So this week we saw the city of Detroit file for bankruptcy, and a judge went in and tried to actually reverse it, and that didn't happen. But we saw this incredible bankruptcy, and what was interesting to me, and Barron's this week talked about it, is that there are maybe a half a dozen or a dozen cities that are even bigger than Detroit is right now. Detroit has shrunk so much, and that are falling right behind them. And chief on the list is my hometown of Chicago, which is an awful, perfectly awful state, and the state of Illinois is in a perfectly awful state. I think the unfunded pension liabilities in the city of Chicago are something like $36 billion. That's with a B. So very, very serious problem. But the unemployment rate is sort of interesting as well, because when you look nationally at the unemployment rate and you look at what it means for labor participation to have just over half of the employment population ratio, but it's 58.7%, just about half of the working population, working age population, is actually working, is a real problem. And this, according to the guy who used to calculate these numbers, Keith Hall, he's the former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, he thinks that if you actually look at the people who are not showing up in the official unemployment rate, then you would get to a much higher number, which would be about 11%. And that's still not what the U6 is, which is the total market of unemployment, right? The total ones, the people who have thrown up their hands and gone off and decided to go back to school or are working in sort of a black market, trading economy, living in the gray market area. All of these different people who don't even play a role in this unemployment rate. And why should you care about this? Well, first of all, if you have been unemployed for more than a year or two, which is the longest number of the most number of months that people have been unemployed in any recession for length of time is right now. So if you haven't been able to get a job, then this is important to you. But if you are nervous about your job, if you're nervous, if you're in the manufacturing area and your company is a little bit unstable and hasn't really recovered, you might be very nervous about joining this group. Or if you've just decided that you're going to throw up your hands and move on to somewhere else and trying to do a lateral move, and that's not working out so well, that also should be a concern. But for all of us, the big issue is whether the government is actually cooking the books to get that number down to give the Fed a backdoor excuse to pull back on the $85 billion of bond buying it's been doing every month in order to keep interest rates low, artificially low, some people think. And so Ben Bernanke, over the last few weeks, has hinted that he thinks that the unemployment rate is a little bit too optimistic, but at the same time, he talked about how in September he's going to pull back on bond buying. He's going to ratchet it back, maybe by $20 billion a month. And then the first time he said that, the markets went wild, and the stock market fell like 200-something points, and we saw interest rates jump up. And that's what happened over the last few weeks, right? Now what's happened is he said, well, just because we might pull back on this doesn't mean interest rates have to go up, and we're going to keep interest rates low, and we're not going to see that dramatic rise. So what does it really say? And I'm going to sort of ask this carefully, and I'm happy to take some calls on this. What does it really say about the economy when the most consistent voice over the past 8 or 9 years has been Ben Bernanke, a student of the Great Depression, right? That was his area of expertise when he came on board, the Great Depression. What does it say about the economy when the Fed is talking about pulling back on stimulus, but at the same time talking about how the unemployment rate is actually probably higher than anybody suspects? There's a push-pull going on there, right? Because if you pull back on bond buying, you're saying that the economy is recovering. But if you're really saying that the unemployment rate is perhaps 3 points higher than it actually is being reported, then you would want to continue the bond buying at full strength or even increase it in order to keep interest rates low and try and stimulate the economy. There's a push-pull going on here that is roiling the markets and I think making people who watch this stuff a little bit crazy. It just doesn't seem completely connected. It's like push-pull, back and forth. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com and midday every Sunday with Elise Glenk on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
It's 54 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. We have, I want to talk about the IRS. There are 4 million U.S. taxpayers who work from home, according to the IRS. And that seems like a very small number, but it's been growing. And the problem, I think, for many people taking the home office write-off is that it's so complicated, right? You have so much to do. You've had to fill out Form 8829. There are 43 lines. There's complex tracking of expenses, repairs, utilities, and all that kind of stuff. And there's the depreciation, and I don't know. It's all crazy. But starting in 2013, the IRS is going to offer a simplified home office deduction. And if you are just using your house in a very small way and you're not running a major complex organization out of it, this might actually work for you because it's not going to require the same level of proof that the other deduction does. Like there are a lot of enrolled agents and CPAs and tax preparers who feel that just putting down home office deduction raises a big red flag for you and you're much more likely to get audited if you have a home office deduction. But the new version, which is much more simplified, it has a cap of $1,500, while the typical or the average home office write-off was $2,600 in 2010, which is the latest data available. And the new method has the lower cap because it allows you to take a full write-off for mortgage interest and property taxes on Schedule A itemized deductions, right? The simplified one imposes a one-size-fits-all value of $5 a square foot for home offices, right? So off the top of the bat, if you're in a pricey metro area, maybe even in Atlanta, that's not going to work for you. But you can take it up to 300 square feet, so it just automatically works to $1,500, and it's easier. So they are taking a look at this to try and allow, recognizing that more and more people are working from home, right? So they're taking a look at this, and they're going to, I think they're still calling for comments on it, but this year they're going to allow you to do, you know, back and forth, and I think probably most tax preparers are going to go back and forth and test it, the deduction, both ways. And that way, if it's cheaper for the, or you get more of a write-off for the regular full 43-line way, you'll go that way. And if you don't, then you'll just use the simplified one, right? So you'll be able to figure out what is going to be the best way to go. Okay, it is 57 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I should probably say that if you want to take a look at this, IRS publication 587, business use of your home. Just go to irs.gov and type in IRS publication 587, business use of your home, and this is going to pop up for you. What else do I want to say about this? Ah, there's the music again. maybe it'll play this time. One thing about this new deduction, with the original deduction, if you use it and you show a business loss, you can carry that loss forward, but with the new one, you can't. So if you have a business loss, I don't believe you're going to be able to carry that forward. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. When we come back, talking about investing in real estate and what happened with interest rates this week, which I think is notable. They've come down again, and that's really how this recovery has been the whole way. 404-872-0750, lines are wide open. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours and your home office here on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glenk is on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, it's 12:07 on News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glenk, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Lines are wide open, 404-872-0750. If you want me to pay for the call, I will. 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can also find me on Twitter at Glenk. Currently having some conversations with people on there. Happy to do that with you as well, at GLINK. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com. It has a whole new look and feel. Really cool. It's introducing our brand new thinklink.com store, where my team and I have got the Intentional Investor Series up. Use code WSB for a 25% discount on anything in the store. That is the best deal going right now. 404-872-0750. Let's go to the phones. Philip joins us on the line from Cumming. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Elise. How are you today?
You know, it's a good day. Trying to stay dry. What about you?
Just enjoying the free sauna out here in Cumming. As soon as all get out, if it gets any more humid, we're going to have liquid sunshine.
That'd be interesting to see for sure.
Yeah. Hey, Elise, I was listening to you. I appreciate your guests and your comments. It just kind of, I've been listening to other money talk shows and just had a kind of a question kind of crystallize. And I don't even know how to get a handle around the information to even formulate a ballpark guess. I'm trying to make my question as concise as possible. I was wondering if you happen to have any kind of a sense of a feel for a ballpark figure of what would it be, what would the percentage of the able working Americans, okay, if you have our population 300 million, say like, for example, 160 million are able to work, we only have, say, for example, 60 million, and there's a percentage of just the able working people. What percentage of the able working people working, what percentage of them working does it take to pay the bills for this country?
I don't know that I understand the question particularly.
Okay, okay, just if you look at the United States, it's just a great big
household. Wait, we don't work to pay the country's bills. We work to pay our own bills. But we do. Yep. Are you asking a question about taxes? Like what percentage of your income it takes to pay taxes or what it would take to get us entirely out of debt? So I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Okay. There's only so much money that can be generated by tax revenue. And so I'm wondering, I guess it is kind of a tax question, what's the ballpark figure that take to pay our bills? I know we have a president who just likes to spend ad nauseum like there's no tomorrow.
Oh, we've had several presidents who like to spend, of both persuasions. Let's just call it what it is.
It's true. Although this one hasn't had to have has not had to deal with things like Katrina, a mutual fund meltdown.
You know what? We can go both ways on that. The point is they both like to spend. So what is your real question here?
So I'm trying to. I was wondering if you could formulate a guess on what does it take? What percentage? I'm trying to look at the percentage of people who are working. We're talking about people on unemployment. The real percentage figure. And so it's down from what it was, a high, probably under Ronald Reagan. What would the figure be where we're breaking even as far as paying our bills insofar as revenue generated through income, tax income, coming into the government to pay the bills so that we're not... I know we're spending way more than we're bringing in.
It happened. You know, I'm going to answer your question. I don't have a specific number for you, but here's what I think and suspect is the answer to your question. It has less to do with people working. The labor participation rate is 5% below the height of where it was before the recession, so it's about 58%. And when you talk about able working people, that's just not how it's quantified. It's working age population.
Okay.
Right. That's how that is the official classification. So it's working people who are in the area, in the age bracket of working age.
Okay.
Who are eligible to work.
Right.
So that percent. Hold on. I'm getting to your question. Hold on. So that percentage is 58.5%.
Okay.
That if you got back to 63%, it would be about another 8 to 11 or 12 million people.
Okay.
Working, which would be great. But none of that is as helpful as having corporations pay taxes and do better. Companies that are not doing well and not making money, their share of revenue to the government is far and away what brings down the deficit over typical people paying in. So what you really need to heal are... not just, you know, people getting jobs is a reflection of a much healthier economy. And a much healthier economy comes from companies that are stronger and hiring more people. So what you really want to look at is corporate profits and corporate tax revenue.
Correct.
Over individual revenue. Because if I hire you at $35,000 a year... I, as an employer, am paying a share of your tax revenue to the government. So that has to be, that really is more the measure, I think, from my armchair, that I want to watch, is corporate participation in the tax revenue role, and is that going up? And what you've seen over the last year is that share of tax revenue has jumped and is contributing much more strongly to bringing down deficit spending than anything on the individual side.
Okay.
It's got mass and scale. Does that help sort of quantify it a little bit for you?
Yes, it does. I didn't even know it could be have a percentage figure put on it, but
I'm sure somebody out there's got that number. I wish I had it at my increasingly dying brain cells, but I don't. So I can't tell you. I can tell you that there are people, though, who do watch it, and I've seen a number like that come into play. But I do know from all the reading I have done about the economy that what we really want to see are companies getting stronger and hiring more people is just a subset of that. We want to see them get stronger, and we want to see them pay taxes in this country, even at whatever level it is, because that's actually where it all is so much better and stronger. 14 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Link, Rebuilding America. Let's go on with another call. Brian joins us on the line. Hey, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what's going on?
I got into a little bit of trouble a couple years ago because I was, I lost my job and whole story. And then I had to file bankruptcy. I don't remember. It's the one where you just consolidate everything and I've to pay it off in 5 years.
Okay.
And I'm about halfway through that. So, of course, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel coming through. So I'm trying to figure out what would be my next step to do after the bankruptcy is finished.
Well, when you have filed for a reorganization, you need to go step by step through and figure out exactly where you want to be. So are you going to have everything paid off in the 5 years, and how many more years do you have to get through that?
I'm about halfway, so I got about 2 years left, and the only, basically the only thing I'll have left it will be our mortgage.
Okay, well, that's good, right?
Yes.
All right. Have you, so you've got 2.5 years to go. So what you want to do is what everybody else does, which is you're going to have basically zero credit when you're at the end of that process.
Right.
Your credit history will probably be, well, we know it's got a big black mark on it for about the next 10 years, but your actual credit score will probably be either in the upper 400s or low 500s. Right? So the whole goal is for you to build that back.
Right.
And there's actually a couple of things you can do. So did your reorganization leave you with any credit cards?
No, I have none.
Okay. So what you want...
And I had none when I didn't have any when I went into the bankruptcy.
Really? How did you end up in bankruptcy?
Like I said, I lost my job, and we got too far behind on my house. And instead of doing like everybody else did and just going ahead with the foreclosure, we did the bankruptcy so that we could at least keep the house.
Okay. So what, you know, what I want you to think about is, first of all, you're going to have to start from the very beginning. Because if you haven't, was that a real, why did you choose to have, I'm going to back up just a minute and ask you, why did you choose to have no credit cards?
Just because I didn't like the fact of, you know, of, I don't know, I had some bad history with them in the past, and we had gotten some really, you know, high, I think at one point we were over probably $25,000-$30,000 in credit cards, and we paid all that off, and I vowed never to have one again because it was just, you know, it was easy and easy money, and I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to go through that all again. So,
so
I started, with, other than our essentials like the house and our vehicle at the time, I had, you know, basically just said, okay, fine, we're just going to pay cash as much as we can for everything. If we did, if we couldn't pay for it for in cash, then we didn't need it, or we had to wait until we saved up the money to buy it.
I wish you had called me before you had filed bankruptcy. I do. Because
I didn't even know you were around before then. So.
Oh, man, I wish you had called me. If I could rewind your clock for you, I would do that. All right, can you stay with us, Brian? We have to take a short break and do some news,
sure.
But I want to come back and I want to specifically answer your question because there are some things that you're going to be able to do, and you're building from the ground up, and I want to make sure this time you build your credit correctly, all right?
Okay, thank you.
All right, stay with us. It is 18 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America. Starting with your house on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
24 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. We've got a prize pack. We're going to do that in a few minutes. We were talking with Brian, and Brian went through bankruptcy, has no credit cards. He lost his job, fell too far behind the house, and instead of doing a foreclosure, did a bankruptcy in order to keep the house. And, I said, Brian, before we went off to commercial break, that I wish I had, you'd called me before all of this happened. And you said you didn't know who I was, so I'm glad you now do. But the problem is that you went for the big black mark on your credit before you actually looked at maybe, and maybe you did explore some other options, but there was help for people who lost their job and couldn't make their mortgage payments, where they would just literally stop all payments due for up to 6 months and sometimes as long as a year.
Right.
So there were other, may have been other options. You went with this one, so now you're in a situation where you didn't have any credit cards to begin with. So now when you come back, you have this big black mark of bankruptcy, and you've got an open slate for rebuilding your credit, and I want to help you do that. So you're going to find it very hard for a while to get any sort of credit cards.
Right.
And I assume you now have a job again, right?
Correct. And one of the things I was going to tell you, too, my paycheck roughly averages around $1,000 a week, and because of our stringent budgeting and everything else, and I also have a military pension, we're able to save roughly around $500 a month.
That's great.
We're starting to try to get a substantial savings in the wings.
I love that. But at some point in time, you're going to need credit because
right.
you aren't going to be able to buy another car, you know, without getting a car loan, I would imagine.
Right.
At $500 a month, it's still going to take you a while to save up even for a used car. And things
right.
happen, right? Cars break down and houses need fixing. And, you know, if you've got kids, they need stuff too. So I want to make sure that you have the ability to get the loans that you need when you need them. And so one of the things I'm going to recommend for you, there's a company that I am on an advisory board for called eCredible. And they help people who have no credit. I've had Steve Ely, who's the CEO, who's been on the show any number of times to talk about this. It's a company that helps people who are unbanked, who have no credit, or who, like you, had credit but went through a bankruptcy or foreclosure. And there's 88 million Americans who are in this position, who are just like you. And it's a free service. You go there and you sign up. It's eCredable, eCredable.com. And they have lenders, once you get an A or a B in their system, who will help you. Road Loans, which is one of the biggest online applications, places that people go to get car loans, they're part of this as well. And so what it does is it gives you the ability to actually get the loans that you need when you need it. And while you're doing that, after you go through that for a while and you get your back on track with your mortgage and all the rest, you'll start to be able to do a gas card or a secured credit card. And so slowly, piece by piece by piece, you're going to be able to build that up. For some more free credit information, I'm the managing editor of the Equifax Finance blog. It's got 800 or 900 pages of information on it, all free, from Equifax, which is one of the credit reporting agencies in the country. You can go there and read all about the Credit 101 and get some more great information on how to build this piece by piece over time. And that's what it's going to take. Time, Brian. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time on News Talk WSB. Hey, it's 12:36 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours, number 404-872-0750. 1-800-WSB-TALK. We didn't get a chance to do our WSB McDonald's weekend prize pack. We're going to give it away right now. A pair of tickets to see the Bare Naked Ladies in concert July 26th at Verizon Amphitheater. Verizon Wireless Amphitheater, produced by ASO Presents, and a McDonald's $25 gift card. Awesome. The prize pack line, 404-741-0750. We'll give it to our fifth caller. The 26th, I think that is the day that we do Carathon, right? I believe it's Friday the 26th, so after Carathon, you'll be heading off, if you win this prize pack, to see the Bare Naked Ladies, which would be cool. And I'll be wishing that I was with you, but will not be. But Carathon is still Thursday and Friday of this week. It's very exciting times at WSB. As you've heard me say so many times before, my two favorite days of the year. The prize pack line. I did give this out. 404-741-0750. Did I not give out that number? That is our prize pack number. Sorry about that, Crystal. Be nice to Crystal because she is going to take your calls if you call the prize pack line. How's that? But Carathon are my two favorite days, Thursday and Friday. And Walter Reeves and I are going to do our annual Inside and Out of This House show from 8 to 10 Thursday night. Very excited about that. We're also going to, or I will be, in the manning the call center Thursday afternoon announcing our hour-end totals. And Friday, I'll be there doing the totals all the way up until the very end, and it's such a fabulous job to be able to say how much we've raised. And hopefully, fingers crossed, we're going to have a great year. Thank you in advance for participating, and hope that you will be able to join us for our 13th year. In sum, we have given over $10 million. I know that that number is actually significantly higher now, but maybe it's even $11 or $12 million. It's such a huge number that we've been able to give to the Aflac Cancer Center, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, to help cure cancer in kids. And I can't think of anything more important than that, really. We started this so many years ago. This is our 13th year. My kids were so little when we started. There was a year when they came and helped out. It's just very special. So I hope you can join us. If you're not going to be in touch Thursday and Friday, you can actually donate now and be part of the cure. You can go to WSBRadio.com and just hit the Carathon button, and it'll take you to a place where you can donate. All right, 404-872-0750. We're going to go back to the phones. Duncan joins us on the line. Hey, Duncan, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
How you doing, Elise?
You know, it's good. It's a good week. Trying to stay dry. What about you?
Same here. I love the rain, though.
Rain is great, just not when you're getting buckets of it.
Yeah. I just had a couple questions for you.
Okay.
In 2008, I had lost job, house, everything.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, but things turned around. And so I got a good job, and I ended up having to file Chapter 13.
Mm-hmm. Reorganization.
Yeah, which I really hated to do because I used to have perfect credit. Well, what I did is I got a couple of secure credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
By the advice of a loan officer, and she told me how to use the cards to build my credit. So I took her advice, and I did that. In June, I purchased a brand new home. I got 4.25% interest rate. Now, I'm still in the Chapter 13. I have 7 months left, and I'm wondering how...
That's pretty impressive. Okay, let me just stop you and say, you got a new house with a 4.25% interest rate, and you're still in the reorganization.
Yeah.
I would say that your credit is healing itself just fine.
Really? Okay.
Well, because typically with a bankruptcy, that can put you in a black box for 5 years. And it sounds like you just about got to 5 years. But
yeah, I have 7 months left.
Yeah, but even so, you were able to get a house. And,
right.
You know, when everybody started going and doing foreclosures and short sales, they instituted a rule that said if you had a foreclosure, you wouldn't be able to buy a new house for 5 years. And if you did a short sale, it would be 3 to 5 years. And here you are in bankruptcy, which is arguably a blacker mark on your credit than either foreclosure, deed in lieu of foreclosure, or short sale. And you're able to get a house in 5 years or a little less than 5 years.
Right.
That's impressive. So that to me is a sign, another sign, that the credit markets are coming back from this kind of extreme position that they were in, where, you know, the pendulum swung all the way from, okay, you have a pulse and a credit score, we'll give you a house or a loan that's 10 times your income. Like, we went from that extreme all the way to, we're only lending money to people who don't need it. thank you very much. So we've moved back. What you're telling me is that your loan, your lender has moved back a little bit from that extreme edge of not wanting to lend to anybody to give you a loan, and that's pretty great. So what is your question for me?
The credit cards that I have, they are 30% interest rates.
30%?
Yeah, they're like high 20s, close to 30.
Are you carrying a balance?
The only thing I do is I may charge $50 worth of gas, and then I just pay them off. I don't charge any more than $50 on them.
Okay, so then it doesn't really matter whether it's 30% interest rates or 100% interest rate.
Okay, I knew you.
Are you ever, because you're not paying any of it, right?
Right.
So tell me why you care. Why are you worried about this?
Well, I was wondering, should I just keep them? You know, do I just hold on to them for the history of, you know, having credit and showing that I'm paying on time?
Mm-hmm.
So just keep them?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that's really important in your credit history is your payment history, right? So how do you pay on time? You're paying on time and in full every month. That's the best.
Okay.
But the next piece that's really important, that is the length of time you've held specific pieces of credit. So I have credit cards that I've had for 25 years. If I got rid of them, I charge a couple of things a year on them. If I got rid of them, that would be a huge chunk of my credit history down the drain.
Okay.
They show how I've managed credit over a quarter century. So I have a credit score in the 800s because I've managed all of my credit really well for a really long period of time. If you take a piece of that out, a long piece of it out, it's a problem. Now, if you have two or three credit cards, all of which have credit histories at least 20 years of length,
mm-hmm.
and you cancel one of them, it probably doesn't make a big deal of difference. You'll see maybe a temporary blip, and then it'll come back. But if you have, all you have are these five-year-old secured credit cards and nothing else, and you get rid of them, what else do you have to show your length of payment history? I think it would have a very significant impact on your credit and your credit score. So I wouldn't advise doing it. What I would advise doing, and maybe you're already doing this, and this is such a key part, the next big step for building on top of secured credit cards, you need to apply for a major credit card. Have you done that yet?
No. I mean, do you think they would allow me to have one? I mean, you know, being as though that I'm still in the Chapter 13, or should I wait until...
You have to wait. I think you should wait till you get out, but I think what you should do, and maybe, have you done this yet? Pull a copy of your credit history and credit score from annualcreditreport.com?
Yes, I have, and it's over 700 right now.
That's amazing. So I don't know that you need to wait. If your credit, you've gotten a mortgage, your credit score is over, before I say that, credit score, which credit score did you pull?
All three. I pulled the, what do they call it,
The Tri score? Is it a,
right.
But from Equifax, it's like a FICO-based score?
Yeah, it's Equifax, Experian, and what's the other one?
TransUnion?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the question for you. There's a score called the Vantage credit score that all three of them participate in. Then there's the FICO-based score that they all participate in but is based on a different model. So 700 on a FICO score?
Uh-huh.
700 on a FICO score would be great because the maximum number is 850. 700 on the Vantage score is like a C or a C minus. Because that score goes to 990.
No, this was FICO. And I had a friend of mine, he's a sales manager at a dealership in Maryland, and I had him pull it for me. That was FICO, so that was like 727. Yeah,
great.
It was 727.
Okay, good. Because I think people often get confused between the Vantage score and the FICO-based score. And then they think they have a 700 or a 720, and they think it's fantastic, and it's like a C-minus, as opposed to what it really should be, which is a B or a B-plus. So anyway, if yours is based on FICO, then I don't think I would wait necessarily to start with the you know, it's 7 more months and you've got credit. So if you waited, it would just probably continue to go up. Once you're discharged the bankruptcy and you're done with it completely, it's probably going to be even higher. And you could get a credit card then. I would hate to see you get rejected for credit right now because you're so young in rebuilding your credit.
Right.
But you're doing a great job. But that's the next step for you, is to get a major credit card and to continue to charge a little bit on that and pay it off at the end of the month, and that's, you know, the end of it. And mostly it sounds like you're living in cash again, which is great.
Yes, I am.
How are you sleeping at night, Duncan?
Beautifully.
I mean,
at least this house is 3,900 square feet. It's on a basement. And I bought this house at the time when no one was buying. So I got a deal on this house that is just outrageous.
That's great.
I mean, it's outrageous. And I was going to wait until the bankruptcy was over in 7 months because I wanted to, you know, lease a car. That's all I've ever done was lease cars. I never purchased cars. So I'm wondering how long should I wait after the bankruptcy before I even go to a dealership?
Well, your friend is a dealer, so he could probably answer that question for you.
Yeah, I know while I'm in it, I would have to get permission through the trustees. I don't even want to have to go through all that stuff.
I don't know why you would. If 7 months is going to be here before you know it, and the best thing about the 7 months, well, is it going to be the beginning of 2014? Is that when you're over, or the end of 2013?
February
of next year. It's a perfect time to buy a car. I actually would think about buying a car instead of leasing a car, because I don't think you get as good a deal when you lease. I think those days are gone now, people are buying. So I would think very carefully about the financial repercussions of that, because if you lease, you have a payment forever, and when you buy, you don't.
Yeah, I'm looking at a lot less coming out of my pocket versus financing and the options that I have. I mean, I won't have any maintenance costs.
Yeah, there are definitely pros and cons, but when you've got interest rates as low as they are, buying a car should be cheaper than leasing, especially if you can plan to hold it like I do for 10 or 12 years and you've got a good car and, you know, you don't have a lemon and all the rest of it. But that should be a less expensive way to go. But you should do the numbers and see. But in the meantime, congratulations, because what's happening is you're really rebuilding your life. You're rebuilding your own financial house, and you are the essence of where you've come from being a disaster in 2008 to owning a 3,900-square-foot house and having a 700-plus credit level and almost being out of bankruptcy. Congratulations. You are doing exactly the right things. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. It's 1250 on News Talk WSB. It is 1257 News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Klink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. You can always send me a question. Go to thinkglink.com. Click on the Ask Elise button. It'll take you to a page where you can fill out your little form. In the meantime, I do want to go over my rules for rebuilding America, because I think that as we heal, and it is so slow, so painful, it's people like Brian who really begin to understand how much time it takes, the length and breadth of the recovery. Somebody who went in and lost their job in 2008, one of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who lost jobs month in, month out, and now 5 years later, I can't even believe I'm saying this, that it has been 5 years. 5 years later is coming to a place of healing. Has come all the way from lost job, nearly lost the house, filed bankruptcy, rebuilding with cards, secured credit cards, and now 5 years later has this beautiful house and a 4.25% mortgage. It's truly amazing. So the rebuilding, the healing is going on for so many people. And if you want to rebuild yourself, your family, your finances, your small business, your community, You've got to get yourself to ground zero. Rule number one, take the pain now. It is so much easier. Even though it's painful, it may be the most painful thing you've ever done. Take the pain now. It is easier than in the future. Make strategic, not emotional decisions. Strategic, it's so key. Any buying decisions, you've got to put substantial cash down. You cannot mortgage your future anymore. Decide that you're not going to. And then finally, don't sign until you read every word on the page. That's all I can say. I'll see you this week for Carathon, I hope. I'll be in the call center on Thursday starting at 1:55, I think. Hope you'll join me there. And then Walter Reeves and I are going to do our Inside and Out of the House show Thursday night at 8. Don't miss it. Have a great week. Until then, everybody, see you soon.